Welcome back to Call Time with Katie Birenbaum. It's been so great to be back, and I'm thrilled with the responses to last week's episode with lighting designer Wheeler Moon. He is really the future of lighting design, in my opinion, and it was great to have someone on the design side of NA on Call Time because we're continuing in that streak and now welcoming the playwright of NA himself. In addition to writing the amazing NA, my guest has written other award-winning plays like Tailspin featuring Rachel Dratch, Commander, Santa for President, and This Is What I Know. He's also an accomplished screenwriter. He wrote the screenplay for critically acclaimed Dark Waters, directed by Todd Haynes and starring Mark Ruffalo and Anne Hathaway, and for which he and his screenwriting partner was nominated for a Humanitas Prize, a USC Scripture Award, and a Satellite Award. Many of his plays and screenplays, as you might be able to tell, deal with or cover politics, which makes sense. My guest immigrated to the United States from Chile, where he then grew up outside of Washington, D.C., and worked for years as a congressional aide. Having worked on one of his plays, I believe you can see all of that in the writing. I'm so lucky to have been able to work with this playwright even a little bit in directing the regional premiere of his play at Barrington Stage, and now to have developed something of a friendship. So without further ado, please welcome to the show Mario Coria.
Hi, thank you for having me.
I'm so happy to have you. And now we've been able to like work together in the city. We're getting into an
know.
artistic rhythm.
It's fun. Yeah. Laptops across from each other, pressuring each other to keep working. Yeah. I love
Exactly.
it.
Mario was like, "You're writing something really intensely." And I was like, "No, it's just an email." And all my friends can attest I have a very aggressive typing vibe. So if you can handle
You
that,
do.
then.
Scary. I was cowed by it.
Oh, no. Well, we wouldn't want that. Well, I'm so happy to have you on the show.
Thank you.
It's going to be great. I'm curious. I want to start at the beginning. You ultimately immigrated to the United States at a very young age. I believe you were six. Chris, did your interest in writing and theater start that early? When can you trace it back?
Yeah, we didn't know we were immigrating initially because my dad worked in the Chilean Foreign Service. He was stationed in Washington, D.C. So originally we thought we would be here for just 2 years. And that was really a big part of sort of our family life because every December was when they told you if you were getting extended for another year. So for years, like December was when we heard, oh, are we staying or are we going? So we lived with that little bit of Damocles sword there. You didn't really want to go back to Chile in the 80s. And yeah, and I do remember writing things from a very young age. I remember, I think the first thing I ever wrote was like a prayer for their Thanksgiving meal. And the reason why I remember writing it is because my dad, he's very cute, but he went down to a printer or something and they had it printed as if it was published work. And so I think at a really young age, like maybe 8 or 9, I believed I had published something. And so maybe that filled my head with outsized expectations. And I always enjoyed writing. I tried to write like a book when I was a kid and stuff like that. But I never really saw it as a career for some reason, even though my dad had written books. That's how he got into the Foreign Service. He was a cultural officer. So he'd written books about Chilean culture and Chilean history. And I don't know why it didn't sink in. I think it's because, to be honest, we always thought we were going back to Chile. And that made me a little anxious. Spanish was my first language, but English became my stronger language. And so I didn't know much about living in Chile. We would travel during the summers and visit relatives sometimes. It was very expensive, so you didn't do it a lot. And so I didn't know what there was in Chile to do, you know what I'm saying, like professionally. So I think that's probably one of the reasons why I didn't have a well-formed idea of what it is that I would one day try to do.
I was going to ask your initial writing when you were a kid, when your dad like fake published this thing, it was in Spanish or was it in English?
It was in English. I always wrote in English, even though I came, it's funny, I came, yeah, I turned 7 the month that we arrived, and I spoke no English at all, and went to, I guess, first grade shortly thereafter. And for much of my first grade, I don't think I really knew what was going on, even though you pick up English very quickly at that age. I think I only remember understanding English in second grade, but I have no memory of trying to write in Spanish. And it's embarrassing because now when I write to my family in Spanish, I rely on WhatsApp on like the autocorrect to fix my spelling. I speak Spanish just fine, but I never learned it in school. And so I think very basic spelling and grammatical mistakes.
Interesting. And do you dream in English? This is a question that I ask bilingual friends all the time. It's like the key question, right?
I dream mostly in English, not exclusively in English. And it's funny because I don't have an, maybe others would tell me differently. I don't have an accent in Spanish. I speak Spanish like a Chilean would. So it's like a, it's almost like a tricky thing. And then I sound much more Chilean than what I was raised. But I think in the last really 5 to 10 years of my life, I really embraced my identity in a way that I didn't for a long time. And that was because we kind of lived with this fear of returning, and personal fear. I'm not saying my parents were fearful, but I was. And also, I think being closeted and gay sort of played into not wanting to go to Pinochet's Chile. But so I really emphasized to myself and to others sort of my Americanness or my perceived Americanness. And it actually was super tough for me to get my citizenship because our visa status, we were not under a normal sort of visa where you accrue years towards residency or citizenship. So I was always trying to cling on to Americanness. It's so silly. And really only in the last 5 to 10 years of my life have I realized just how much I was doing that, and really even become much closer to my family and my extended family in Chile in that time period. As I realized, I'm staying in the United States. I'm married to an American as well. My life is here. My professional life is here. Why am I anxious about these things that I'm anxious about? I've never really talked about this, interestingly. Yeah, we've been to this little segue.
How, even just the subject of language, like what languages you speak in what contexts can really get deep so quickly because language is so personal, and especially for immigrants, I think it's so tied up with identity. And I'm sure something you write about that's at play in NA.
Yeah, and it's funny because I think NA is the first time that I've had, I know it's the first time that I've written a central Latino or Latina character. It may even be the first time I've written a Latina or Latino character full stop, if I think about it,
Wow.
which is so nuts. It is so nuts. And I think that's a reflection of sort of some of the things that I was thinking about and worrying about, which was sort of about coming out and other things about politics, and then taking time to come into my own and the experience of NA, not to jump too much into that, but with Ana Villafañe, who plays the character of A, the character inspired by AOC, she was so instrumental in sort of me think really coming to terms and embracing things that I hadn't. She brought my best Latino out of me.
I think that's fantastic. Yeah, and I think it makes sense with what you were saying about how in the last 5 years you've been grappling with this, why do I feel the need to be I'm so American, I'm Latino as well, and then you write this play that happens to be your first foray into your personal identity as a Latin American person. I think that makes a lot of sense. You were clearly interested in writing and language from an early age. When does the theatrical or the filmic come into play?
In seventh grade, I was cast as Charlie Brown in our school
Oh my
musical.
God, I would love to see you do Charlie
Oh
Brown.
my
I bet
God.
you'd be a great Charlie Brown.
Oh my God. You know, I do have a very large head, and I say that I've come to terms with that too. And so I'm sure that it's a bit of a typecasting situation, but I loved doing that play so much, that musical. And a guy named John Schwartz, who you may have read, he writes for The Intercept and a bunch of other, he's a progressive journalist, really bright guy. He played Linus, and he had a legitimately beautiful voice where I had a, I think, fine voice. And I remember a family friend came to the show, and I saw her after the show, and she says to me, "Oh my God, Linus's voice was amazing." And I think that moment was like, oh, This is not for me. I'm the lead. No, I'm kidding. I think my parents didn't really encourage.
Titular role.
I know, and I feel bad. I'm not trying to throw my parents under the bus here, but they didn't really encourage that part of me developing. I think it was alien to them. Chile and the education system there is very pre-professional.
That makes sense.
You go, like, at age 17, you decide if you're a physician. You go to, like, medical school at age 18, and the same thing with law and engineering and everything else. And I think if I had developed a little bit of my own interest that time, I probably would have tried to be an actor, to be honest. But the real theatricality, I think, probably began when I was like 17 years old, and a woman knocked on my door. She was running for Congress. I was home for the summer, and she seemed very nice. And I told her there was no one in our house who could vote. We weren't registered in the United States. But I would help her on her campaign. And I think there's nothing more theatrical than politics. So I like to think that really my theater career began when I went to work for her. She was a candidate for Congress in Montgomery County, Maryland. She was a Republican, and I was raised in a Latino Catholic family. And so that's what you did. You supported the Republicans. And only when I joined her campaign did I come to realize that she was like this unicorn. She was this very progressive, pro-choice, pro-gay rights, pro-environment Republican. And there were some back then. This was a long time. So I found myself working for her, and she was a professor of Shakespeare at a local community college. And she Her name is Connie Morrell. She's still with us. She's amazing. And she would include Shakespeare in her musings and her speeches. And when she won this seat, which no one expected her to win, it was a very tough race. She invited a few of us to go and work on her congressional staff. I changed my plans to stay in college, to stay locally for college. I was planning to leave DC for college. And so I stayed in DC, went to college there, worked for her part time when I was a student, and then for a number of years thereafter. And when we would write a letter, especially a thank you letter, you would include like a little Shakespeare quote at top. So for a while, I knew a couple of quotes from like Henry IV, Part One, or I don't even know if that's the name. It's all now jumbled in my mind. It was like, I remember she used to say, "My staff and my rod, they comfort me." But I think that's biblical, right? That's not big for anyway. Whatever. She just loved drawing from literature, and so even though I was working in politics, I think I was continuing to be influenced, and I was very much influenced by her in all kinds of ways, very positive ways.
It's so interesting. Yeah, I think people don't think necessarily first thing of like politics and theater going together, but it's funny. I obviously do theater, have loved theater since I was a child. Kind of always knew it was what I was going to do, but my other main thing in school growing up was politics. I was like class president or whatever, and I did model Congress.
Oh,
And I think, and when I was in college, the eating club that I was in, which sounds, ridiculous,
yeah.
co-ed fraternity, was theater people and it was politics people. And everyone was always like, why do those groups of people necessarily go together? But having been in that club, it's dramatic people, it makes total sense.
Yeah, no, I think it's like it's very outward facing, and like, and even though working in theater, depending on what role you play, can feel, as a writer, it sometimes feels quite internal until you have a chance to elaborate and the thing gets on its feet, which is why I love theater much better than any other kind of writing. But you are facing the world, and you are putting something into the world, and you are presenting ideas, and you are being judged and evaluated for those ideas. And that is very political. So I'm not at all surprised that you found yourself in your eating club.
I feel like theater makers debate this all the time, and I was going to ask this later, but it feels relevant now. Do you think of theater as being inherently political, even if it's not a political story like NA or whatever it is? Do you see it that way, especially today?
Yeah, that's a great question. Yeah, it's a great question because I'm writing something right now. I am adapting a memoir. The memoir is called The Empty Room by a wonderful writer and person named Elizabeth DeVita Raeburn. Elizabeth is the sister of Ted DeVita, who suffered from something called aplastic anemia, where his immune system collapsed, and he lived at the National Institutes of Health for many years, for 8.5 years. And Hollywood stole his story and bastardized it and created this movie called The Boy in the Plastic Bubble, which is not the story of his life at all. And anyway, she wrote a beautiful memoir called The Empty Room about life with her brother and surviving the loss of her brother. And I read it and I just thought it was beautiful. I wanted to adapt it. So I approached her and she very generously let me do that. And this is a very long way of saying I'm writing the first non-political thing I've ever written. The first one that doesn't touch at all upon politics. And in fact, it's so funny because when Elizabeth and I met, she told me that she hates politics, as many people do, rightfully. And when I invited her to MA, I thought, oh gosh, she's going to hate this. But she didn't. In fact, she really appreciated it. And I think for the same reason that these stories are about humanity. NA was set in the world of politics, but it's really about identity and change and progress, which comes to pass in so many facets of life. And boy, this is a really long answer to this question.
No, I mean,
But
it's a deep question, so it requires a long answer. Yeah.
yeah, this is my test to myself. Can I write something where I'm not in any way opining about the public sphere? And I think the answer is everything in some ways about the public sphere. So, in the case of this play, her brother's life was sort of quote unquote cheapened by Hollywood. And in her book, she really reclaimed his story and her story. And that's what I'm hoping to do too in this adaptation. And so, it is political to reclaim your story and to demand to be telling your story and to not let others decide what your story is. So the short answer is no. There's no difference between politics and theater. How's that?
I think that's great. It's something I thought about a lot when I was working on your amazing play because it was the first time I was working on a play that was set in the political arena and with recognizable characters that we all know from politics. And I was excited by it, but I was sort of like, is this going to be different? And at the end of the day, it's still all about like character and motivation. And so I guess that's the flip side, which is like the political can also be not political. It can be of the everyday. And then the reverse is true, like what you're saying, that especially today, like anybody taking a stand and reclaiming their story, like this person that you're writing your next play about. And taking up space, who might be the type of person who doesn't usually take up space or have a claim to that in the current political administration, is political. So I don't know. I've been thinking about that a lot, mostly because of your plays, which is cool. You mentioned you're working on a new piece, and I know that you're working on a number of new things. What is your process like for either plays or screenplays?
Good question. What is my process? Usually on screenplays, I've done them on assignment. So I've pitched the idea. My first screenplay was something called Let Her Speak, which again is a political story. It was a telling of Wendy Davis, the Texas state senator who in 2013 filibustered to shut down the Texas Senate, which was trying to at that time shut down most of Texas's reproductive health clinics. And so hers was an extraordinary story about one person's determination to fight and to not give up. And I love her and I loved her story. And I love her, the person. We become close. And I pitched that story out in Hollywood after a producer had read a play of mine called Tailspin. So I pitched and then I was given a very small amount of money to write it. The only reason why I say that is because this was not like some Hollywood ever. All that is to say, each time I've worked in Los Angeles on TV or movie stuff, it has been an assignment where I have something that someone is expecting. And that sets certain parameters around
Right.
your process, like deadlines and certain expectations. When I write without an assignment, it's funny, it is an essential, central question, and I should have a better answer for it. I will tell you that this weekend I bought a laser printer, which I live in a very small apartment in New York, do not have room for much of anything, including a laser printer. But it's because I'm at the stage with this play where I need to print it out to actually look through the pages and make edits. And I only print out the pages when I feel like I am almost done. So for the better part of a year and a half on this play, I have been typing away as often as I can. I get up pretty early and go to a coffee shop and do that kind of a thing. But I know that I have reached a point where I'm feeling pretty good about it only when I otherwise desecrate our environment by printing it out on paper, or in this case, buy a printer to do that. So it's not a very good answer to your question,
No,
but
but it's good where either way, because you pitch this story in Hollywood or you're writing this play inspired by this memoir, where do you tend to get your inspiration? Is it just like you'll read something? Are you always trying to read as much as possible because that's where you seek inspiration? Is it from your own life? I don't know. Different playwrights are really different in that way, so I'm curious about that for you.
it's a really good question. It's funny. I worked in LA for a number of years, and there is this culture out there where everyone is always trying to figure out, is that IP? And can I option that IP, or can I work on that IP? And it is exhausting. And your mind kind of gets a little bit of that because you can't help it because everyone is doing it. And it's like, you can't say to a friend of yours, oh my gosh, read this article. It's interesting. Because the next question is, is it a movie? Oh, and that is exhausting. And I don't do it that way. I really write only things that feel personal to me. And for example, Wendy's story, the Wendy Davis story, which is called Let Her Speak, the script, which is in development. Hopefully, we'll have it made, but it's a long road. When I wrote it without knowing Wendy Davis, I just read everything I could about the events of that day. And I also read her memoir, which I really appreciated. And then I wrote it the best I could. And when I finally did meet her, it was when the thing already existed and it was out, and there was like a movie star attached and blah, blah, blah. And so I was nervous for her to read it because I'd had no contact with her. And she said to me when I met her, she said, how did you know, this about me, or that I was thinking this or feeling this? And I told her, honestly, I think I wrote it from the perspective of what I observed my boss, Congresswoman Connie Morala, experiencing on Capitol Hill when I worked for her. And that was that doors were always being shut. She had to find a way in through a window or a way out. She had to make her own way. The system was not built for her. Expectations were always against her. And that's what Wendy's story was about. So, another long answer of me saying that whatever I write, even if it's in the world of politics, and I've been out of politics for a while, is something experiential about me or what I've felt or witnessed. And the story goes through that. In the case of this memoir that I'm adapting, I lost two siblings actually when I was much younger. And that wasn't something that we talked about a lot in my family because you just don't. It's sort of the model of that is in those families, you avoid discussing that pain. And when I read Elizabeth's book, even though it's about a very famous young man and a very famous situation, what I read in it was like, oh my gosh, this is my experience of how you don't talk about it and how you try to find a way through it. And so I do think I just try to find personal connections to everything. And in fact, when assignments come to me, knock on wood, that assignments will continue to come. Sometimes they come, sometimes they don't. I really have a hard time adjusting and writing what someone else wants you to write. The movie that became Dark Waters came to me as an assignment, but that was a little bit different. It was based on a real story, and I thought the story was interesting. But more than anything, it was being directed by Todd Haynes, a director whom I just adore. And honestly, that movie could have been about anything, and I would have still tried to write it. So there's different inspirations from time to time.
It's so interesting also because when you were telling that story about Wendy Davis and she was saying, how did you know XYZ? Having worked on one of your plays, as someone who loves research and dramaturgy, it was so cool and fun to, wake up to an email from you that, like three books and seven articles. And I say that in a completely complimentary way. Like the research, you don't seem to write plays, maybe this will change, but you don't seem to write plays that are like, two people in a room and a chair. Like, there's a lot of
Yeah.
character and research and historical work to be done, which is my favorite kind of work.
You're sweet to say that because I wish I did write things
And
that
you will, I'm sure, but it's.
require that research. And it's funny, I love this book, The Empty Room, that I'm adapting. And obviously, I've read it very carefully, taken tons of notes on it, and sat with Elizabeth and had conversations with her. But when I sat down to write, I'm not referencing it a lot, though, because at that point, I'm sort of channeling my experience or my understanding of her experience. More importantly, hers is the central point of view. And I think this is also teaching me to move a little bit away from that current events model, which has been where I focused. That said, in my own defense, no, because you and I have talked about this because it's central, which is in NA, the character of N is based on Nancy Pelosi, the character of A is based on AOC, inspired by these two women, and it's a dialogue, intergenerational dialogue about how to create change. And the reason why I didn't want to use their names, and I get asked this a lot, and so I'm sort of preempting it here, is because I do feel like people come into those stories with such preset ideas. I know who Nancy Pelosi is, I know who AOC is. And even though I'm not going to shake that from them just by not including their names, I was amazed if a character is N and a character is A, and in that rehearsal room, they're referring to themselves that way. And they are building a different person. And when you watch the performance, I hope this was your experience as well, they are a character and you're mimeographing people's real life biographies or whatever.
Totally.
Talk about a current term. Does that exist? Mimeograph machines? I'm thinking about it because it comes up in this story in this book. But anyway.
Yeah, is that like a copy machine?
Yeah, it was like an old-timey copy machine. I mean, not, I mean, it was used actually when I was in school. So yeah, no, it is old-timey still. But it was definitely used when Elizabeth was in school because she and I are about the same age. And yeah, so I have mimeographs on the mind.
No, I mean, I think that's true. And when I started in the rehearsal room with those amazing actors, I said very clearly and inspired by you, I don't want impressions of people. Like, this is not SNL or who can do the best impression of this real life person. The dream is, and it sounds like you have accomplished this both with NA and with this next play that you're doing. And I say, as a director, the dream is to be so well researched and so well versed in the world that once you're actually writing in your case or working in the rehearsal room in my case, you don't have to think about any of that. And then the character just comes to the fore. And I
Right.
think it's difficult. I don't know. That's just how I work as a director. I would find it difficult to be able to work in that organic and natural a way without doing the research, especially if they're real life people or based on real life people. But yeah, everyone works differently, but I think that makes a lot of sense. You've spoken about working with this congresswoman, and obviously you've written a great deal inspired by your time with that. So tell me about how and why you circled back circuitously to writing or theater and film from the world of politics.
I always think of this. I don't think she thought of it, but Juliana Hatfield, the singer, songwriter, she had an album called Become What You Are. And I don't think she came up with that expression, but it always stuck with me. And for a long time, I did not become what I was. And in a lot of ways, I worked in politics, which I loved, as I mentioned, we talked
And were your
about.
parents like, what? Were they like,
I think no, they kind of liked it. They were very supportive. And I was working in the US Congress. I was very young. I started at age 17 and I went through age 25, so less young at the end, but and it was wild. I had to get like a special permission to work there from like the
I
state.
wanted to be a teenage congressional aide for a bit, and then when
Yeah, I mean, it was
I moved
kind of
to DC, it's scary.
yeah, it was like Doogie Howser, congressional. The theater folks will get that reference, right?
Yes.
Yeah, and I really enjoyed that. I loved my boss and I loved American government at the time and American history. And I felt a part of something really significant that I wanted to be a part of this country. And then when I left Capitol Hill, I didn't at that time have more imagination about my own life or career. So I ended up becoming a lobbyist in a high-tech trade association, which is, what you do in DC. You become a lobbyist, you become a lawyer, or I don't know even if there was another option at the time. I certainly couldn't think of one. And that I realized pretty fast was not for me. It wasn't like an evil thing. I lobbied on copyright law. So it was like,
Sure.
but it was nothing I cared a lot about. And I was in that sense chilling for Microsoft and a couple other companies. I was like, I don't really, Microsoft doesn't need me. Nothing that I do needs to necessarily happen, or at least I don't need to be the one doing it. And so it was starting to weigh on me. And then my closest and oldest friend in the world is a guy named Mo Rocca, who folks might know from CBS Sunday Morning and other things. And
Yeah.
he was always a very creative person. We've been friends since we were 8 years old, and we used to like write things together when we were growing up. And we both almost got suspended because we had a gossip magazine in 7th grade called Insight. Mo was the face of it because he has a much better personality. I was like the guy behind the scenes. But anyway, and we've always been in close touch. And he went on to really make a go of it and make a career in entertainment. And then when I was in my 30s, one of the gigs that he had was he was hosting a show on Animal Planet, which was called Whoa Sunday with Mo Rocca. And what it was essentially a series of comedic interstitials that they would put between the night's programming on Animal Planet, jokes about like sharks, if the show was going to be about sharks or whatever. And he was just kind of like hosting the night, kind of like a Wonderful World of Disney type thing. And he basically gave me a job writing those alongside Nell Benjamin, the very talented Nell Benjamin, who folks know. And I was keeping my job during the day. I was a lobbyist during the day, and I was writing these interstitials at night for Mo's show. So he, in many ways, and he's always done this for me and to me, is giving me of that opportunity that really led to other things. And it was being exposed to writing in the industry and television at the time through that experience that I thought, oh, you know what? I'm gonna really make a go of this. It took a few years, but I eventually would leave it behind DC and moved to New York and properly focused and started writing plays.
Wow, you never told me that. That's so interesting. What a transition.
Yeah, it took me a while. Even when I decided, boom, I'm gonna make this change. You're basically like hanging on to a ledge with your fingertips still. I was doing writing projects, but for corporate clients. I was scared, I guess, about not being able to pay bills and eat and all the things that people tend to want to be able to do. And it was only, oh, this is why I mentioned that quote. It took me a while. It was only when I started writing plays, and I chose to write the first play about politics, about congressional sex scandals. That's what Tailspin was about. That the whole write what you know thing. I was writing what I knew, and I was becoming what I was, which is someone who really is interested in politics and likes talking about politics and writing about politics. And so I eventually found myself through writing. And I think that's why for a long time I wrote about politics, because it was the most intrinsic thing to me.
Do you feel like you got the last chopper out of Nam in the sense that you like politics when you did?
Yes, gosh, for sure. And I look back at that time and I remember wanting to be a member of Congress and my dream of dream. I was like, gosh, I couldn't think of nothing more honorable than doing what my boss was doing. And she represented the neighboring congressional district to Washington, D.C. So she was in Congress during the day and then with her constituents at night. And I was with her most of the time. I've been to every senior center and blah, 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 all the rest of it. And so I saw how she related to people and how much what she did mattered to them. We had a very unique bird's eye view into how Congress works, because every night we were back in the district, with the people that she was working for. And I just thought that was really incredible. I thought what she did was incredible. And though I never would have articulated it, because I don't think I was even a citizen at the time, I knew that in my heart of hearts, that's what I wanted to do. And now I think to myself, like, you could not pay me to be a member of Congress. Like, you could not, nothing in the world could make me want to go there, even knowing that a lot of good can happen there if the levers of power are used for good. But it is just so toxic and terrible. And I do think sometimes, gosh, what is that 21 or 22-year-old staffer who I was, what is she, what is he, what are they experiencing Because it's not what I experienced. And boy, to be sent out into the world having that be your formative experience is scary.
It's something I think about a lot because it used to be that, like, the best and the brightest minds, like, if you wanted to make a difference, you went into politics, like the Roosevelts, the Kennedys, the Pelosis of the world.
The Nancy Maces. Sorry, I couldn't resist.
No, I know, but and now I don't know. It feels like the best and the brightest of my friends, even those who wanted to make a difference, like who didn't want to be an investment banker or something, none of them wanted to go into politics. There just seems to be this sort of complete acknowledgement of the reality of the situation, which is that that's not how you get things done anymore because it's so toxic and gridlocked, and people are going into tech or nonprofit work or whatever it is. It's really a shame because then it creates an environment where the people that you mentioned before are leading the charge, who I don't know necessarily what their intentions are. And as you said, I don't know what the 21-year-old congressional aide's experience is now. I don't know if it would be life-changing in the same way.
And if it's life-changing,
For the worse.
exactly, it'd be scary. No, it could be scary. Yeah, no, that's really sad. And you're right. Congress is not where the best and brightest go in either direction. You know what I'm saying? Because even if you want to do good, you realize that's not gonna do it unless I don't want to discourage people from running for Congress and trying to make a change. God knows we need it. But yeah, sigh.
Sigh, major sigh. Start writing plays, and then a producer saw Tailspin and was like, "You should write films too." How did that happen?
Yeah, I got super lucky. How did it happen? Tailspin started at the Fringe Festival. The first thing I did, I wrote it for the Fringe Festival. It got accepted. Again, Mo Rocca played a huge role because he told me he wanted to be in it, which I think he was just pretending that he wanted to be in it because he knew that his decision to be in it was going to get the thing the attention it needed to get a producer, to get a director, to get us a little bit of money to put it up. Marianne Mills and Billy Zavalson, who put it up at Fringe for us. Once again, big helping hand there. So then a manager came to see Tailspin. I was given his name through friends, and he came and saw Tailspin, liked it, and sat me down afterwards and said, "Oh, I would like to represent you. And I think you could write for TV and for film." And I thought that was crazy. It had never really been my ambition. And I also didn't really see the connective tissue. But he shared Tailspin with a producer out there who liked it and said, "Okay, I want you to go and think very carefully and pitch me something." And I didn't go and think very carefully. I knew exactly the story I wanted to tell right away. And I said, "I want to tell Wendy Davis's story, and this is how it is." It was very from the gut, because that's the story I wanted to tell. And it took some convincing to convince him, because it's about abortion rights. It takes place in one room. There's lots of things that don't feel particularly filmic or certainly Hollywood about it. But he's a good guy. I appreciate very much that he took it on, and he went from there.
You're an interesting person in the sense that you didn't go to get an MFA. I don't think you were even an English major in college, were you?
No, in fact, I only took one English class the entire time that I was in college, which I'm so sad about in hindsight. My gosh, I had the
What was
opportunity.
your major? Like politics?
And it was a double major in government and economics. I did not understand economics, did not like economics, but my parents, poor thing, who were having to pay for this American college education, which for a Chilean is, that's astronomical for anybody, but particularly was coming from a culture where you didn't mortgage your house to be able to go to college for your kid. My mom was like, "You need to study something practical." And though it pained me then and still does, I understand her thinking.
My dad was an economics major, and like he's like a hippie aide, and I guess he had a roommate who was in his economics class but had literally never gone to class and was going had to take a final, and my dad was like, "All you have to know is the X graph for supply and demand."
The only reason why I even knew it or could even remember it was because D comes before S and it's alphabetical. So I actually couldn't intellectually comprehend why this thing went one way, this thing went the other way. And I was memorizing it based on the order in the alphabet, which tells you exactly all you need to know about my knowledge of
You're a
economics.
playwright.
Oh
A
my God.
playwright for sure. Anyway, you didn't go to school for any of these things, and then you didn't go for screenwriting, obviously. So how did you just try to see as much theater and as much film as possible and then go from there?
I always loved seeing theater and would try to come up to New York before I lived in New York. It's funny, I don't consider myself a film buff. And I'm not one of those people who has great knowledge of the history of film and could tell you what film is the most influential in terms of this, that, or the other. Although, like anybody, I have my favorites and the things that I appreciate. So theater was really what I loved most, what I love most. And when I started to write plays, it was just instinctual. And sometimes that can really work for you. And then sometimes you make glaring omissions. Like I remember, for example, in Tailspin, it was the story of four members of Congress who had sex scandals. And each was a scene of the vignette of each person's sex scandal. It's based on actual documents and tweets and secret IMs and all the rest of it. But I didn't have an opening scene. I didn't have a scene where we just met all four of these
Right.
men and Rachel Dratch, who played all of their wives, all of their mistresses, all of their interrogators. And I thought to myself, when my director, Dan Connectus, who's a great and thoughtful guy, he is the director over at Tutz now, the artistic director, he said to me, "We need an opening scene where we meet them all together before we go into each of the scenes where we go into each of their scandals." Now, it is frightening to me that I did not know that by instinct. But on the other hand, that play, I'm proud of it because it was pretty experimental. It used only verbatim text from these.
Wow.
There was nothing in that play did not come from a secret email by them or a police report from when they were caught or something a reporter asked or something that they answered. The entire play is entirely verbatim, but just mashed up. And so it was different. And I think if I had been taught traditionally, I wonder if I would have gone in that direction. But this is maybe a kind of cool story to share at the same time, which is that the order of these four scenes included early on that of Mark Foley, a congressman who had basically been texting with an underage House page. And it was gross. It was kind of yucky to sit through, even though it becomes comedic the way that we told it. And James Lapine, who I didn't know at all, but was a friend of Dan Konecta's, came and saw, I think, our dress rehearsal or maybe a first preview. Dan said, "James, give us notes, please." And James said, "You got to shift the order so that we don't see the child predator so early in the play. You have to basically win the audience's love for the piece before smack them with the story of the predator." And again, that may or may not seem like something that I should have known from the start, but boy, I was lucky to get that kind of advice from someone like James Levine. We changed the order.
That makes me think of, have you seen Every Little Step, the documentary about?
I love that doc.
In some ways, I don't actually think it's better than A Chorus Line, but I love that documentary. And I love when they're talking about the makings of the original musical and how the song was called Tits and Ass originally, and it was getting no laughs, I guess. And I forget who it was, maybe Neil Simon's wife or something. I can't remember exactly. But someone came in and was like, you give away the joke in the program. Like the audience can see it, call it something else, and then it'll be a big reveal and they'll all laugh. Sometimes you just need fresh eyes like James Lapine or Neil Simon.
No, that's such a cool story. I love that doc. And while we're on docs, the best worst thing that ever happened, that doc about the original production of Merrily We Roll Along. Have you seen that?
I haven't seen it, but I've been told I have to see
You
it.
got to see it. It is incredible. And now that Merrily has been recovered in the canon or whatever, it has a happy ending because the happy ending in the doc is a little more elusive.
Total love. And then there's also a doc about like the race between Avenue Q and Wicked for the Tony Award.
Yes, I think I saw that too.
Pretty good. So many good theater geek got docs.
Oh.
Speaking of all these things, would you say you have a style as a playwright or screenwriter?
I was thinking about that recently because in working on this adaptation I'm working on now, I have a lot of characters sort of zipping in and out, the actors double, and a lot of like fragmented sentences, like people finishing each other's sentence and folks coming in and an idea being chopped in half and someone else comes in. And I thought to myself, oh, is this a little annoying? Will the audience feel like, hey, I just finished a damn sentence? And I thought to myself, one, maybe, but two, you know what? I like doing this. This is kind of what I do. In NA, there's less of that because NA is more of a debate and ideas need to be fully. And because these two women are coming at things from such different sides, they were not going to be finishing each other's sentences. That's probably the most important reason why. But in these other things, I realize I love fragmented language. I love rhythmic language. That's what Tailspin really was. It was someone that worked on it described it, and I hope I'm not trying to be self-congratulatory here because he said, this is not a play, which was not the nicest thing that I heard. He goes, it's like a movement. It's like movements of music, and each of these scenes is a movement, and it's rhythmic. And if I had a style that I gravitate towards it's rhythm of language, I would say. Hopefully I'm not trying to be self-promotional. Maybe no one sees any rhythm in the language, but that's what I aim for.
No, I think that's true. Having worked on, been so deeply in your play, NA, every scene has a kind of musical rise and fall. And I think my favorite straight play playwrights are very musical, and you are one of them. I love musicals, as my listeners know. And I think it's great when plays have that momentum and have that rhythm, as you say, and that musicality that you can see the arc of the scene, you can see the arc of the play. Yeah, that's really cool. So this is a stupid question, but given how rhythmic and musical your writing often is, do you have to read it aloud to yourself or do you read it like with someone? How does that work?
I think to the consternation of all the people at the coffee shop, I mumble it to myself.
Or
So
you're
even you
just another
probably
crazy person in New York, and that
know.
would be the
I
first.
know. Maybe you noticed this when we were sitting together, although you had your earbuds in because you were editing, but I will mumble it to myself as I say it. And the first time I write it is usually because it's instinctual, that's the thing that ends up being the best thing. When I go through and revise and change things, often it just reverts to what it was. Because if you're hearing it, then really the first time you hear it is the most honest time you hear it. I will tell you one quick story about I love our cast in New York. I love the cast of Barrington too, but I got to know the New York cast very well, Holland Taylor and Anna Viafanya. And at one point during rehearsal, there was a line, and Holland said to me, she said, is it it's da 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 or is it is da da da? And I didn't remember right off the bat. And I said, oh, you know what? It could be either. And she stopped and she said, Mario, you are the playwright. This is your language. Is it it's or is it is? And that was one of the many reasons why I just adore Holland Taylor. I was like, oh my God, she's so right. If I can't say it, who's going to say it? Stand behind what it is. Even if it doesn't feel necessarily hugely consequential at that time, there's a reason why you made a choice. And you have to express that choice to your collaborators, or else they'll feel aimless. Oh boy, does he know what he's doing?
I think that makes a total difference because it's musical too, as you're saying. It changes how a sentence is said. I'm curious. We talked about this a little bit, and I've talked about this with some of the other playwrights I've had on the show. One of the reasons I love theater is that it really is like the ultimate team sport to me. It does not happen if it isn't like multiple people all working hard towards a common goal. I love being in the room with all the people. What you do seems a little more solitary because you have to take the time and write, and only if there's a production are you like in the room and doing things. I'm curious if that's like part of the allure? Because I think of you as a social person, or is that like a drawback for you of this calling?
I love being in the room. I really love it. And I think I backed into understanding how important it was because you're not in the room when you write a film, and in TV you may or may not be, depending. But in this, when I got to be in that room in New York with Diane Paulus and Holland and Anna, and we worked things out and cut things on the fly, and I'd come home and rewrite, and now it was just so energizing. And this is why you directing the regional premiere at Barrington was both exciting for me and so
I
scary, very.
could have done anything.
Yeah, because like I had no idea what was going on. I mean, I had faith from both our conversation and what I'd read about you and Alan Paul, who is so great. But you do have to let go at some point, and you just have to decide after that initial burst of collaboration. And you and I collaborated in smaller ways when we had questions or thoughts or things that changed. But at some point, interestingly, the collaboration ends,
Yeah.
and you just have to let it out into the world and trust that it is going to live beyond you.
Hope that it lives beyond. Like when it gets licensed, your play is licensed and published now, like hopefully people will be doing it in small theaters all over the country, and sometimes you might not even see it.
No, that is my hope and my dream with this play, that it gets done a lot. And it was so funny because I was finishing the version for publication right before you were going into rehearsals. So things in the script were changing a little bit as I prepared them for Concord Samuel French. And I was so anxious about sending it in to Samuel French, being like, this is it, because this idea that the thing is fixed
Yeah.
and not going to be able to evolve it was a novel experience for me.
Totally. It's a larger scale version of what directors experience, which is a very bittersweet thing, which is after you like freeze the show, you can go see it, but especially if you're doing a regional gig, you leave and then it's the
Yeah.
actors and it's just like going on. It's theirs now, which is what I always say to them. And I imagine it's something like that, this like strange letting go process.
Yeah, that's such a good point. It's funny because I had a friend who saw the production at Barrington and loved your direction of it, and said to me, "Oh, I looked for the director to introduce myself because he's a good friend, but she'd left," and like scandalized by this. And I was like, "No, this is what happens." But like, they freeze it, they do their work on it, and then it doesn't belong to any of us. It belongs to the performers on stage.
No, it's true. My family, I'm like the black sheep of the family. I'm the only one who's like an artist at all, and they're still surprised and think it's weird that I like leave. And if someone wants to pay me to be there the whole time, that's fantastic. But I do
Yeah.
think it you have to let it go at a certain point because you could note it into oblivion.
Yeah.
And I'm sure you feel the same way. I'm sure there could have been like eons versions of NAs in the world, but it's nice to have at a certain point, like, this is the version and you're done with it.
Yeah. And then if the run is long enough, I appreciate the directors will come back in. And our run in New York was longer. We ran for about 3 months. So Diane came in, Diane Paulus, who I loved working with. She was wonderful and so
Such an
insightful.
icon. When I found
Yes.
out I got the job, and I was like, okay, cool. Just directing it after Diane Paulus. That's
Yeah. No,
cool.
but yours was fantastic. And so
Very
yeah,
nice.
you grabbed the torch. When you and I met, I was telling you about, I've never met a person who has the ability to laser focus as well as Diane does. And I took that away from that experience too, like right
Yeah.
now, this is the only thing that exists. And during the 10-minute break, you can go worry about the other thing, but this is the only thing that happens now. But to go back to what we were talking about, she came in several times because our run was long enough and gave notes and talked to me about it and said, "Hey, this is what I'm seeing, blah, blah, blah," which I very much appreciated. So hopefully in our next experience together, you and I will have a long enough run that we'll
And
go
we
back.
can note the actors. Yeah. So you've told us a little bit about this play that it sounds like you're in the finishing stages of. Is there anything else that you're working on now that you can share with us?
Sure, I am. We recently pitched a couple of months ago a film to a studio out in Hollywood, an independently oriented studio, based on something that happened in 1976 in DC, the assassination of a Chilean diplomat who was murdered in DC with a car bomb. Orlando Letelier, who's a fascinating guy, and an investigation took place that eventually led to the realization that General Augusto Pinochet in Chile had ordered his assassination on the streets of Washington, D.C., in the middle of the day, half a mile from the White House. It is an astonishing and shocking story. And I was approached by a producer about it. And we together went to the studio and pitched it. And we're talking about it with them very actively. If it gets done, it'll be a chance to write about Chile and about what the Chile of that time that I was growing up was. And so I hope that that comes together and I'm excited about that. And I'm also in conversations with the writers of a musical about I'm working on a musical that they're trying to bring to New York. And like you, I'm sure, right? Like a million other things and also nothing. Like it feels, am I doing anything or am I doing too many things? And the answer is yes.
Those all sound very exciting. I wanna, before I do my little ending segment, clearly we can talk forever and there's lots to talk about. A question I ask almost all my guests, do you have any advice for aspiring playwrights or screenwriters who might be listening?
Wow, gosh, I think my advice would be we talked about it a little bit earlier, this idea of becoming what you are. And I know it seems derivative, the whole write what you know thing, but what I mean by it is a little bit more complicated than that, which is that I think, especially in this industry, especially in the Hollywood side of it, so less so in theater, thankfully, but you feel that what you need to put out into the world needs to be this thing that because the world is calling for it, you know? And whether that's like Hollywood is liking this movie or these kinds of musicals are getting made or boy, like one woman shows are the thing or whatever it might be. And this is basic advice. This is not particularly insightful, but it never works. Not just because tastes change, but because people can read authenticity just like they can read inauthenticity. And in my case, the only time I really started getting some traction in my career as a writer or being able to actually solidly move away from my past political sort of stuff was when I just wrote about the things that I really cared about. And I didn't expect that there was much of a market. And some of these stories are complicated. And like you said, a lot of research, a lot of life rights, but I didn't really have a lot of choice because that's what I was passionate about. And that's what really got me on track. So to the extent that people are feeling a need to respond to some kind of perceived market need, it's just not going to work. It will be easier to write what you know, as they say, but also what speaks to you. And it will be the thing ultimately that I think is most productive.
Yeah, I think that's really true. I also think like people are so worried about like, being unique or like standing out. And I think you have, even if you don't think your interests or your life or your passions are that unique, you stand a greater chance of, you know, having your own personal stamp on things, your own personal voice, if it is something you care about and it's very specifically yours. So I think that's really good advice and true and preferable to a lot of different types of art. As a director, I sometimes look at what gets made and what directors are working a lot. And like a Jamie Lloyd, for example, and I'm just like not, I love Jamie Lloyd's Sunset Boulevard. I love his style. It's not my style. And so I think it would read, I'm never going to go out there and be like, Katie Birenbaum presents, you know, Fiddler on the Roof in the style of Jamie Lloyd. It's just like not what I do, and it would read really weird. So I think that's good advice.
And a black slips at the end, one's blood on the other. Yeah, no.
Exactly. I don't know if you saw on the internet, there were all these funny things on Twitter that were like Jamie Lloyd's like next to normal, and it's just like in, you know, boxer briefs or whatever at the end.
Yeah, no, exactly. And I too loved it. I really loved it when I saw it. And I can't imagine wanting to see any think quite like it from anybody else for that very, because it felt special. And yeah, no, for sure.
And why waste time trying to do a my version of what Jamie Lloyd would do would be like a lesser version, obviously. Why would I waste my time and other people's time doing that when I can do the best version of what Katie Birnbaum has to offer, or Mario can do the best version of what Mario has to offer?
Yeah, and maybe this is more concrete advice along the lines, which is don't read. I was reading in the beginning when I started to write screenplays, like screenplay books, and they are so prescriptive. You know, page 11 is the inciting incident. No, blah, blah, blah. And there's 30 Rock jokes about sort of the rules in screenplay books. And I think maybe less so in theater, but I wasn't trained, we talked about it. I wasn't trained as a playwright. So I'm sure there are some basic rules that I'm missing, maybe some for the worse. Maybe I should know some of these rules, but yeah, reading other people's instruction manuals, I feel, is not a good way to proceed, you know?
I think that's very well said. I want to end with my ending segment, the Thank You Five segment, which is like 5 minutes to places in the theater. It's some favorites, so bear with me. First, are there any playwrights or plays that are inspiring you right now? That could be like old plays or playwrights like Tennessee Williams, or it could be like the latest play that you saw.
Yeah, I saw Prince Faggot a few nights ago at Playwrights Horizons, and I was blown away by it. I was blown away. And I just thought it was so innovative and brash and interesting and didn't wait for you to catch up, but just knew that you would get it. And I really loved that about it. My favorite play of all time is a modern play-ish. It Wit. I loved that play, and I loved the story behind the play. Margaret Edson, who wrote, she was a kindergarten teacher who had worked at an AIDS ward at Georgetown University Hospital when she was studying nursing, I think it was, at Georgetown. And she saw the horrors of both the medical system at the time and disease. And she had a story that she needed to get out, and she wrote Wit. And it won the Pulitzer Prize, became, of course, iconic in many respects. Mike Nichols movie, all the rest of it, too, down the line. Judith Light back into theater, all the rest of it. And she has never written another play that we know of. There's some rumors about whether or not she had written another play, but the idea being she had a story to tell and she told it and she was satisfied and she went back and now she works with kindergartners again. And I just think there's something that's so mind blowing about. It's a beautiful play, but it's also, she's like, that was the story I needed to tell. And now I'm going to go back to my life. And then another that I love is 6 Degrees of Separation, the play. I just love that. John Guare, he was my college graduation speaker.
Oh.
Didn't know who he was at the time because I wasn't taking any English classes.
Because
And
you
his
were doing the
advice,
supply-demand curve.
exactly. And I still, his advice was, Johnny, don't get a job. That was the theme of his speech. So, and I just love that play. And it's very musical, like we talked about. Breaking the fourth wall, talking to us, so the musicality of the rhythms of their speech. And I think it was really, I think it influenced me in a lot of ways. I read that play all the time, just reread it. Just
Wow.
kind
I
of,
love that play. I saw the most recent Broadway revival, which I think was in like 2017 or 20, and I
yeah.
had never read it or seen it, and it like blew my mind.
It's something else, that play. Oh my
It really
gosh.
is.
And the film of it, maybe because he wrote the screenplay, is great too.
I've heard the film is good. I haven't seen it.
And how often can you say that?
Totally. Do you have a favorite play you've written, or they're all like your babies to you?
Oh my gosh. Wow. It's funny. For a long time, I haven't written that many plays, partly because of my late start. But when I had writer's block, I may have shared this with you. I was sitting in a coffee shop just trying to come up with something to write. And I saw the anxiety on everyone's face as everyone was trying to get their little table with their laptop to write whatever they were there to write. And I basically wrote a one act about three writers struggling to figure out how to exist in New York. One is an aspiring novelist, one is an aspiring playwright, and one is an aspiring screenwriter. And the plot point is that there's only one table left for three of them. And it's like a battle to the death type thing, not actually, but and it was just because what that's what I was thinking at the time, and I was thinking, gosh, how am I going to do this? And everyone around me is trying to do the same thing. I don't know if it's any good, but I love it because it is very much the thing that was on my mind at the time, and it references John Guare, who shows up in the play telling me not to get a job, which is advice that I took for better and for worse.
There you go. There you go. I think
Yeah.
you did tell me about this because I then talked to you about that play. I'm assuming you know David
Oh
Greenspan.
my gosh. Oh my gosh. I wish I'd mentioned that. Did we talk about seeing that? Yeah.
I think, I don't know if you had yet seen it when I mentioned it, but I saw it and it like blew my
Oh
mind.
my gosh. In fact, I wish I'd mentioned that when you asked me for favorite things. That play is so incredible. And Mona Pierna, exactly. We did talk about this because I said to you, oh, you know what? Not only is that play incredible, but it's the good version of what I think I was trying to do.
I'm sure you did it well too.
She nailed it. She
You
nailed
nailed
it.
it. And David Greenspan, come
Yeah,
on.
of course, of course. Yeah. But I love that play.
Do you have a playwriting or a writing pet peeve? Run-on sentences or, oh, we don't care about this character, that kind of thing?
Oh yeah, that's oh yeah, a pet peeve, and this happens more in the world of screenwriting or TV writing when a producer type says to you, "Okay, this is the bad version of this idea, but," and then they proceed to give you this entire elaborately thought out idea that they think is actually a very good version of this idea that, you know, and I'm not the first to come up with that beef. People joke about that all the time, but people telling you the idea and claiming that they don't think it's a good idea, but really wanting you to use that idea drives me a little crazy.
That is so funny. I feel like I'm guilty of that though, as a director to the playwright.
Yeah.
Like, okay, the bad version would be she says, "What are you doing here?" And then I say, "And but you put your own like playwright spin on it."
Yeah,
I'll try
that's
to
funny.
reel
That's
that
funny.
in. That's
That's
a
funny.
good answer. You've spent a lot of time in DC. You mostly grew up there. Do you have a favorite like DC because DC has a theater scene like eatery that you like to go. Like, is it Le Diplomat?
I've never been to Le Diplomat because I lived in DC before Le Diplomat really came into its own. And DC has a great theater scene. Let's for sure plug DC because it's incredible. I love DC theater. But no, you know what? If we're going to plug an establishment, I will tell you. Okay, it's in Bethesda, Maryland, and Bethesda has some great theaters in there too. It's Tasty Diner. It is a diner. It has been there since the 1950s. It is like one of those old kind of like train things that someone
Oh,
like
sure, yes.
parked. It's been there forever. The owner refused to move when Marriott built this humongous corporate headquarters right around it. So it's literally built all around this diners, these massive corporate headquarters. And the reason why I love that place is because my boss and I would go and have our like early breakfast there before we went to do any politicking, or she would speak to reporters there. And you walk into that diner with my boss today, and now I think she's 94 years old and in amazing,
Wow.
amazing shape. And everyone in that diner will still get up to talk to Connie Morella and to like take their photos. And there's something so small town about it that reminds me of a sort of better time in our country's history in many ways.
I'm gonna have to go there.
Yeah. Tasty Diner. And the food, you know what? The food is not bad. It's, yeah, solid.
I'm going to DC to see one of my best friends. She's the lead in the tour of Parade, and they're doing the Kennedy Center there. So I'm gonna, and I have a ton of friends who live in DC now. So I'm gonna see her do that and see all my DC folks. So staying at the Watergate, which I think is like funny.
It's funny because people, when they think of that Watergate building, of course, they're thinking of the scandal. I think of Monica Lewinsky because when I was working on the Hill, Monica Lewinsky, her dad or her lawyer, somebody lived in the Watergate, as did Senator Bob Dole at the time. And so the scandal, the Watergate scandal of my youth, was Bill Clinton and Monica Lewinsky. Poor thing. She, by the way, is someone I admire a lot, and I love how she has come to really own her story. Yeah.
You should write. I feel like you would be the person. Here's the bad version. You should write a Monica Lewinsky play.
Oh my gosh.
I'm sure it's been attempted.
Yes, and I think there's a musical and all that kind of stuff. It is a good idea for someone to write her story.
My last little ending segment question, I ask almost every guest a version of this, and you can take it literally or metaphorically, and that is, what is to you a playwright's essential? So that could be like a table at a coffee shop, or it could be like determination or a sense of humor or something like that.
Oh, that is a good question. Wow. I could try to give you a more profound answer, like truthfulness or blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
But the real answer is a table, a real table at a coffee shop. I'm not talking about a little where you sit like a one or two person. I am talking about a large table where numerous people sit around you, so you feel the presence of other people and that sort of community which you need as a playwright, and also you can spread out your pages. So I'm going to go with a very literal answer, which is a big table like the one that you and I shared a few days ago over breakfast.
I love it. I love it. That's a great answer. And no one has said that yet. So there,
You
you'll be.
actually gave it to me. You actually prompted me. But
We can cut
thank you.
that part out. We'll edit it in post. Mario, this has been such a fun and wide-ranging conversation as I knew it would be. Is there anything else that you feel like we haven't covered that you want to cover or anything you want to plug?
No, I just want to say thank you to you, not just for this talk, which has been really great and also really profound for me. We talked about things that I don't really talk about that much, but also thank you for being such an amazing steward of NA at
Oh,
Barrington. This
thank
past summer, I feel so lucky to have gotten to see the production and to get to know you. And I'm super excited for all the stuff that I know you're doing too.
Very kind. Thank you, Mario. I feel like it's rare. It's not rare, but you never really know what people will be like. And when we met for drinks in like March or April or whenever that was, I'm sort of like, we'll see how it is. And I don't know. I feel such a great connection to you, and you're great, and your writing's amazing. So, everyone who's listening, NA is published, so you can go read it. And I'm sure there will be other Mario plays and movies coming out. I'm sure you can stream Dark Waters, get him some of those residuals and
Oh yeah, those scents and scents.
those fat residual checks.
Oh yeah, living high on that hog.
And thank you, as always, to Call Time listeners for listening and subscribing and commenting. As always, if you like what you hear, please give us a nice rating or leave a comment or something like that. I always like interacting with you, and have a great week.